Today on the History Factory podcast, apprenticeships, not internships, apprenticeships. I'm Jason Dressel, and welcome to the History Factory podcast, the podcast at the intersection of business and history. In this edition of the pod, I'm going to talk to Ryan Craig about his book, Apprentice Nation, How the Earn and Learn Alternative to Higher Education Will Create a Stronger and Fairer America. The book begins with an introduction titled, We Were Once a Nation of Apprentices, in which Mr. Craig sets the historic context that apprenticeships used to be an integral element of our society's workforce, economy, and education. Colleges and universities and the conventional wisdom, especially after World War II, that they are the path to success in this country, have of course been a huge reason why apprenticeships have for many of us become an antiquated idea. But Ryan Craig's book cuts through a lot of misinterpretations about apprenticeships, delves into why they are being so underutilized here in the United States, the role they play in other global economies, and why they should become increasingly prevalent here in the U.S. And for those of you who are frustrated with the state of our colleges and universities, there's a fair amount of red meat for you in Apprentice Nation, although Ryan Craig is by no means arguing that they are not also critical institutions. So let's get into it. A really interesting conversation with Ryan Craig. Ryan is a managing director at Achieve Partners. He is co-founder of Apprenticeships for America, a national nonprofit dedicated to scaling apprenticeships across the U.S. economy. And in addition to Apprentice Nation, he is also the author of A New You, Faster and Cheaper Alternatives to College, as well as College Disrupted, The Great Unbundling of Higher Education. And given the topic, I also feel like I should note that Ryan has worked in higher education, is a graduate from Yale University, and also has held positions at Warburg Pincus and McKinsey. Here's my conversation with Ryan Craig. Ryan Craig, welcome to the History Factory podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on your new book.
Thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
Well, I guess maybe just like you do in your book, we can just start with a little bit of a level set on what exactly is an apprenticeship, and how is it commonly misunderstood?
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding. Many folks will use internship and apprenticeship interchangeably, but they're really not just different. They're kind of the polar opposites. An apprenticeship is a full-time job where you're hired without having the skills or experience that you're going to need in order to be successful in that job. And there's a formal classroom training component. There's an informal on-the-job training component. Your salary or wage will scale up as you learn more and become more productive. And there are various career pathways you can pursue once you've sort of are officially in the job and no longer an apprentice. But again, it's a full-time job. So unless someone is has hired you and you're receiving a W-2, you're not an apprentice. So that's apprenticeship. An internship is a work experience, paid, hopefully, but often or too often unpaid, that a student will pursue in the course of his or her program of study. Could be during the summer, could be during the term. Sometimes there are universities like Northeastern and Drexel where you're going to do multiple internships before you graduate in field. But internship is the polar opposite because you're a student first and you're only sort of working incidentally and often part-time.
Yeah, certainly our country seems to be far more familiar with the internship concept than the apprenticeship concept, and we'll get into that. But first, Ryan, what's your background? What's kind of led you to be interested in this topic of apprenticeship?
Yeah, so I've been in higher education for almost 25 years. Started my career at Columbia University in the 1990s. And have helped build universities, online universities, build programs invested in companies that work with hundreds of colleges and universities on various things. And about a decade ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to raise capital to found my own higher education focused investment firm. And it was from that that we began to see the sort of negative, persistent negative employment outcomes of the Great Recession, where lots of young people were graduating from college, but essentially graduating into underemployment. So they were getting jobs that their degrees did not didn't require those degrees. And sometimes they were working in retail or, you know, food service after graduating, the classic liberal arts grad working at as a Starbucks barista. So our firm began to invest in what we termed faster and cheaper alternatives to college, boot camps and the like. But even those models did not meet our expectations. Lots of boot camps are a good way to address the skills gap. There are lots of technical digital skills, platform skills that colleges aren't training on that employers are insisting on. We call that last mile training. Boot camps are good for that, but what they can't do is close what we call the experience gap, where you've got millions of employers asking for 3, 6, 12 months of relevant work experience for a job that used to be entry level. So nowhere is that more evident than in cybersecurity, where a decade ago, someone with a modest technical background could get a job as a tier one analyst in a security operations center. So your first row of defense, you're looking at the alerts that come in, you're deciding which you can resolve, which you can ignore, and which need to be elevated. Today, that job has essentially been automated away, and the entry-level jobs in security operations centers are what used to be tier two analysts, which require a CISSP certification, which means 3 to 5 years experience. So as digital transformation progresses, as automation progresses, as generative AI emerges on the scene, we're going to see all good jobs, all good entry-level jobs go the way of those cybersecurity entry-level jobs, where the menial work or grunt work that you used to do in an entry-level job as you kind of learned the ropes and figured out what the heck you were supposed to be doing and how you could add value, that is going to go away. You're not going to be spending 30 hours developing PowerPoint presentations that no one's going to look at. You'll spend 1 or 2 hours doing that, leaving the rest of the work for AI. And the rest of the time, you're going to be expected to do higher value client work, product work, you name it, which you're not going to be able to do without experience. So we began looking at models that could address that as well as the skills gap. We started by investing in a staffing company that staffed software developers to clients. And they could only staff maybe a quarter of the position descriptions they received just because there wasn't enough talent. So we essentially built an apprenticeship program into that company. They began hiring and training new workers who didn't have the necessary skills. We gave them those skills, and that was extraordinarily successful for us. And so now my day job, what I actually do, is I run Achieve Partners and our workforce funds. What we're doing is we are buying business services companies and sectors where there's a talent gap, like cybersecurity, like software development, and we're building large apprenticeship programs into those companies so they become talent engines for their talent-starved sectors. And it's a strategy that works extraordinarily well.
And just to dig into that a little bit, I'm curious before we move on. Why the strategy of buying those companies? Because you believe your firm can ultimately make them better performers and create more value because of the fact that you're solving for that talent discrepancy?
Exactly. We think we're doubling organic growth of these businesses by doing that, by creating a new revenue stream as we're selling talent into the market, and by attracting more attention to our companies as the first and only companies in their talent-starved sectors to be producers of new talent.
Got it. So one of the things I really liked about your book, Ryan, was really the historical sort of context of how you approached this topic. And so that then checked the box on inviting you onto a podcast that positions itself as being at the intersection of business and history. So here we are. But, you know, one of the things that you kind of touch on, and I sort of characterize this as, you know, there's this kind of, you know, the conventional wisdom of kind of the American dream is that, you know, the way to get up and kind of, you know, make a better life for yourself and then kind of put your kids in a better position is that, you know, you go to college, you get married, you buy a house. This feels like it's really been sort of the kind of post-World War II kind of American sort of success, kind of ingredients for success. And, you know, when you look at a lot of our public policies, they really reinforce, you know, that doing those things, you know, there's a lot of public policy that says that getting, you know, people being married and owning houses is good for public policy. So, you know, so I'm just kind of curious, like, one of the things that you talk about with apprenticeships is that we used to be, I think the way you coined it in the book is we used to be a nation of apprentices. So what did they look like historically, and why do we now not really think of apprenticeship as being sort of part of the fabric? And instead we think of, you know, going to college and then getting an internship and then getting a job.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. Up until about World War II, college was still the sort of province of a very small minority of adults. You'd make your way up with some formal or informal version of apprenticeship. We decided that I think the reason is that the idea of college, the idea that everyone should be able to fulfill their potential, discovery. Is an important value. That's all very consistent with the idea of college. That's what college is about. And that worked really well when college cost a couple hundred dollars a semester or a couple thousand dollars a semester. And you could you could live without going into significant debt and attend college. To go from there to college for all or only college, that's the step that we took in the sort of 60s, 70s, and 80s. We really began to disinvest in things like career and technical education at the high school level, in youth employment, right? If the only pathway is one that runs through four-year college, then in high school, you're going to focus on making yourself as attractive a college applicant as possible, as opposed to doing, you know, work as a gardener or a waiter or a server that might teach you a few things about your own interests and capabilities and your ability to support yourself. So that's where we are. And then, enter digital transformation. Enter an era where the skills that employers are having a hard time finding are actually harder to learn in a classroom than they are by doing. Enter the experience gap we just mentioned. And suddenly the idea of, remaining in classrooms until you're, and only classrooms until you're 22, 23 years old makes little to no sense. This orthodoxy that we've established of high school to college to work, it doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. I'm not saying that there's no value to college or that we millions of people should not attend college. What I am saying is the sequencing that we've established doesn't make sense in an era of digital transformation and AI, and that we have dramatically overinvested in this, now very costly tuition-based and debt-based infrastructure for career launch. And we've dramatically underinvested in an earn and learn infrastructure for career launch. But again, I do think that in a world in a decade from now where we have millions of high school graduates starting as apprentices, those millions of people are still going to need additional post-secondary education. But by the time they ultimately enroll, they're going to be much better informed as to what program, what their interests are than they are today, where we have this massive problem of asymmetric information, where you have thousands of underperforming colleges enrolling at-risk students who are unlikely to be successful. And the colleges either do know or should know, and the students themselves have no earthly idea.
Yeah, and I think what you're getting at there, Ryan, is presumably that's also going to help the colleges and universities and the system kind of unto itself be a little bit more sort of aligned with the needs of the economy. Because I think one of the things you're pretty critical of in the book, and rightly so, is kind of the state of colleges and universities and how they're really preparing young people to be in the workforce. And, you know, you mentioned you worked at Columbia, and, you know, you've got degrees from Yale. So, you know, you're a pretty smart guy who's had the privilege to go to some pretty good schools and be part of those institutions. You know, how would you kind of characterize the state of our colleges and universities, and what do they do well, and where are they falling short?
So I think they do as good a job as they've ever done at preparing young people with the critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, communication skills that they needed to be successful in the good jobs of the last century. I think today's good jobs want all of that, but they also want discrete combinations of digital skills, platform skills, business knowledge, role knowledge. And unless they find, and now increasingly with this experience gap, relevant work experience, and unless we can address those, we are basically sort of pulling the ladder up for young people. It's going to be very, very difficult for young people to get good entry-level jobs 5-10 years from now if colleges and universities don't figure out a way to integrate real work experience into their degree programs. We need to do it. Apprenticeship is the best way to do it, because apprenticeships are jobs where you're hired specifically without having the skills and experience you need, and that is delivered in spades over the course of the apprenticeship. But you could also imagine a world where we have systematic, comprehensive internships, right? You could imagine a state requiring every university in the state to ensure that students graduate from four-year degree programs with multiple paid in-field internships. That would go a long way to addressing these concerns. You could imagine a world where students, as part of their coursework, are completing capstone projects that are actually real work projects for real employers along the way. But both of those things would require colleges and universities to have a very different approach and much more developed infrastructure around employer engagement. Today, that runs through career services, which is sort of a backwards corner of the university. And no one else at the university feels like they have any responsibility for career or employment outcomes of graduates, which is why, you know, at your typical school, all they'll be able to tell you about what happens to their graduates is that for the survey we send to, graduates, 85% of respondents report that 9 months out, they're either employed or in graduate professional school. But you don't know where they're employed. You don't know whether they're working at Starbucks.
Maybe they don't want to know the answers to all those.
Well,
questions.
I think that's why I said earlier that there's a little willful ignorance here. And as long as the money keeps flowing, and it's not as though this is a free market. There's a remarkable government subsidy going on here. If you look at total public support for the tuition-based, debt-based career launch infrastructure, aka college, relative to the earn and learn infrastructure, we spend over $500 billion of federal and state money each year on that tuition-based infrastructure. We spend less than $400 million on earn and learn infrastructure. So it's 1,000 to 1. And if you compare the public support that a apprentice receives compared to a college student, for every dollar the apprentice receives, the college student receives $50. So I don't know whether the right ratio is 1-to-1, 2-to-1, or 10-to-1, but I'm pretty sure it's not 50-to-1 and 1,000-to-1. And in fact, no other developed country is so imbalanced with regard to that disparity. Every other developed country is an order of magnitude higher than we are on investment in earn and learn career launch infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's not just the public funding, right? It's like even when you look at the available money through foundations for grants, it's like I would assume even in those sort of other streams for funding for colleges and universities, it's disproportionately in that area versus things like
because that's where we have the infrastructure.
Right.
It's like the guy coming out of the bar looking for his lost car keys under the streetlight because that's where he can see. That's the problem we have. All we have is that infrastructure. We don't have, as someone pointed out to me recently, it's either college or Chipotle, right? You've got like for a high school graduate, college or Chipotle. So this idea of college and career readiness. And there, every state has a college and career readiness standard for its high school graduates. But look at the standards; nothing to do with career readiness. It's all about college, because those are the pathways we have. And frankly, it's because those are the easier pathways to build. Much harder to build pathways that require engagement with employers. But that's the one of the key points of the book is that nowhere where you have a robust earn and learn infrastructure, nowhere where you have a robust apprenticeship infrastructure, do you have one because employers in those countries are somehow more benevolent or farsighted? You have it because there is an ecosystem of intermediaries that are either required to do the work of setting up or running these programs or highly incentivized to do so. And we don't have that in this country because we have not made primarily because we haven't made the investment in that infrastructure.
Yeah. So you've alluded to that, to how it's different in other countries. And I'm just curious to understand more about that. So what do kind of apprenticeships look like and what roles do they play in the societies and education systems and workforces of our other leading global economies?
Sure. So in the US, we have 500,000 apprentices today, civilian apprentices. That may sound like a lot, but it's only 0.3% of the workforce. And about 70% of those apprentices are in the building or construction trades. Compare that to the giants of Central Europe, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. Probably most of your listeners won't be surprised to hear that they're 10 to 15 times better than we are on a per capita basis. So instead of 0.3%, it's 3 to 4.5% of the workforce are apprentices. But I bet your listeners will be surprised to hear that in the UK and Australia and Canada and France, they're doing 8 times better than we are. And a generation ago, they weren't. A generation ago, those countries looked a lot like the US in terms of having a small apprenticeship sector, mostly in the construction trades. Whereas today, it's very common in those countries to launch a career in healthcare or financial services or tech or logistics as an apprentice. And so what happened? And what happened was those countries recognize the central role that intermediaries play. They recognize that employers don't create apprenticeships of their own will, primarily because the very notion is anathema to most employers. The notion of hiring and paying a worker who's not going to be productive for an extended period of time is not something your average employer is excited about doing, let alone all the other stuff in terms of recruiting and training and coaching and mentoring and registering the program that they would need to do. So hard to do. But employers don't do it. They in Germany, they're successful because these massive chambers of commerce and trade unions are actually required to set up and run these programs. It's written into statute.
Right.
But what the UK and Australia did is they recognized this and they essentially overfunded the cost of training to incentivize staffing companies and HR services companies and nonprofits to get into the business of becoming apprenticeship service providers. So now you have in the UK, you have this robust ecosystem of 1,200 apprenticeship service providers who are in the business of going around knocking on the doors of employers across the country, across every sector of the economy, offering to set up and run apprenticeship programs for them. In many cases, making it completely turnkey for the employer. All the employer needs to do is put the apprentice on their payroll and pay the reduced apprentice wage. Everything else is handled by the apprenticeship service provider. And that's how they got to 8X, the US. We don't have that infrastructure because we have not invested in apprenticeship intermediaries the way other countries have.
And before we kind of shift off of that, what's apprenticeship look like in some of the Eastern countries? Like I would have guessed that it's pretty common in like India or not so much.
I think informally, again, any country where you don't have as robust a formal post-secondary or tertiary education sector, informal apprenticeships thrive. But it's largely because employers have no alternative to sourcing.
Got it. So in the book, you outline a pretty practical blueprint or roadmap for how the United States can make apprenticeships a more integral part of our society, our education system, and economy. So tease enough of it to make people want to read the book. What's the elevator pitch on that? And sure. How is it maybe similar or different to what those other countries like Canada and the UK have done?
Yeah. So the big thing is that right now we have huge barriers and effectively zero incentives to creating apprenticeships. We need to invert that. We need to significantly reduce the barriers, and we need to dramatically increase the incentives. So today, an apprenticeship service provider looking to sell an apprenticeship program to Verizon, they would not only have to ask Verizon to pay the apprentice wage, but they probably also have to ask Verizon to pay an additional $10,000 to $20,000 per year fee for everything that they would be doing. Mm-hmm. So in other developed countries, that's not what happens. That funding is essentially provided by the state, and so it makes it much easier for employers to say yes to apprenticeship. In addition, they would have to register, jump through hundreds of pages of federal paperwork or state paperwork to register the program for effectively no benefit, because there's no funding that flows with becoming a registered apprenticeship program today. So those are the two major things. There are other things like skills frameworks. Every apprenticeship program in this country, you have to sort of develop that from scratch, whereas other developed countries have established skill frameworks for every apprenticeable occupation. We don't do a good job around ensuring that professional licensure is limited to those professions that really and degree requirements that are associated with professional licensure are limited. We allow professional associations to own their own licensure decisions, and they erect as many walls and dig as many moats as they can around the profession. And adding degree requirements to professional licensure effectively makes an occupation non-apprenticeable. States also need to be doing a lot more. In the UK, 25 years ago, as they were reaching their apprenticeship inflection point, some enterprising reporter asked the Ministry of Labor, well, how many apprentices do you actually employ? And the answer was none. And so today there's a rule in the UK that 2.3% of ministry employees need to be apprentices running their own programs. And so we are going to see movement here. Colorado just became the first state to direct its agencies to set up and run apprenticeship programs. And just as we've seen this rush of states remove bachelor's degree requirements from their state job descriptions, I think 16 at last count, I expect to see a similar number of states doing that. So, I mean, the good news here is that there is widespread agreement on both sides of the aisle that this is worth doing. I think it's particularly good politics for a Democratic Party that is widely viewed as a party of college elites. Politics aside, it's going to become an economic necessity because technological change is going to make career launch much more challenging in the decade ahead.
Yeah. And what challenges do you potentially see with just kind of the stigma? You know, as we mentioned before, you know, sort of the conventional wisdom for so long has been that the way you get ahead is by going to college. Do you see that as one of the significant barriers, just changing sort of public opinion and perception on the importance of college?
No, not really. I think that will change once we begin to build this infrastructure. I know from our programs that we've developed in all these areas, software development, cybersecurity, and the like, that if you offer a paid pathway into a career without requiring skills or experience, you get hundreds and hundreds, sometimes thousands of applicants for every seat. Unfortunately, the selectivity in these programs is worse than your Ivy League school. If there's a ton of demand for this, the problem is that when people think about apprenticeship today, they think about plumbers and welders and roofers because there just simply aren't enough apprenticeships in the sort of high value white collar or new collar and technology primarily fields that really need them because it's going to be hard to get these jobs any other way.
What was one of the biggest kind of surprises you had just in the process of the research and writing this book?
I say the biggest surprise was how poorly we're spending the money that we actually are spending on apprenticeship today. The Office of Apprenticeship at the Department of Labor, they're now up to almost $300 million a year in funding. But rather than providing formula-based or what we call paper apprentice funding, like other developed countries have, where you're literally only paying once an apprentice is hired, they're providing grants to organizations that tend to be good at applying for Department of Labor grants, which are community colleges and workforce boards. And what they're doing, rather than actually creating apprenticeships or resulting in the hiring of apprentices, they are developing curriculum for the classroom component of apprenticeships. They are registering the program, and then they're sitting on their hands waiting for an employer to come along saying, hey, I'd like to use that curriculum for my apprenticeship program. But I can guarantee you there's not a single employer out there that would launch a program but for, you know, unable to find curriculum for the classroom component. And so when I created the directory of the book, which is a directory of all current apprenticeship programs, registered and not in the United States outside the construction trades, so tech, financial services, healthcare, and the like, I started with the Federal Rapids database, which is the database of registered apprenticeship programs. And I asked, well, how many of these programs are outside construction? And the answer was 6,000. Mm. And then I asked, well, how many of these 6,000 are actually real apprenticeship programs, meaning that you could apply for a job as an apprentice tomorrow and someone would actually look at your application? And the answer is, of those 6,000, only 200 were real. The remaining 5,800 were what I call paper apprenticeship programs, meaning they exist only on paper, meaning a community college has developed curriculum, registered the program. And if you go to the website, it's the community college essentially marketing to employers saying, hey, you want to adopt our curriculum? So I think that's a big surprise. And I've had done a number of talks before folks from the Department of Labor. They're not fans of mine right now, I would say, but there's no vigorous disagreement. The one point I had is like, well, we do performance-based funding because we provided a grant. We had a grant program last year where states received awards based on their promises of performance. And I said, well, what actually happened to the money? Do we know whether it actually resulted in apprentices being hired? And they said, well, no, that's out of our hands.
The money was invested for the colleges to have a sales program to sell to a company if they ever call.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can do a lot better with the money we're spending. And I think once we do that, we'll begin to get this flywheel spinning, get folks realizing just what the power of apprenticeships can be.
Yeah. So Ryan, what's kind of the most misunderstood notion of apprenticeships, and what's maybe the one or two things you just would want everyone to know?
Yeah, I'd say, well, for folks in the policymakers, the folks who are making decisions on this stuff, the biggest misunderstanding is that apprenticeships have been lumped in with other workforce development and training programs, and they're not. They're different. They're jobs. And so whereas much of the $3 billion that we spend out of the Workforce Investment Opportunity Act every year, the Department of Labor is administering, is we see not great employment outcomes, Job Corps being a premier example of that, over $1 billion with very little job creation, except for the people who run Job Corps. They have good jobs out of it. But apprenticeship is different because these are jobs. This is not about training primarily. It's about convincing an employer to hire a worker who's going to be unproductive for a period of time. It's about employer behavioral change. And so it needs to be treated and thought about and funded differently from the way we currently fund workforce development. And that's what every other developed country that's way ahead of us has already recognized.
Yeah. Well, and maybe ultimately what's needed is a little bit of a rebrand where they're not even called apprenticeships. They're called jobs with some parameters.
Yeah, I've had that. It's, a bunch of folks have asked that. I think that, again, that will solve itself the moment that you become familiar with apprenticeships in cybersecurity and software development and all the fields that college students are having an increasingly hard time getting those jobs.
Yeah. Great. Well, Ryan, awesome conversation. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience and perspective. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. Enjoyed it.
All right, folks, that concludes this episode of the History Factory podcast. If you enjoyed the discussion and are interested in learning more, check out Ryan's book, Apprentice Nation, How the Earn and Learn Alternative to Higher Education Will Create a Stronger and Fairer America. Thanks again to Ryan Craig. As always, thanks for listening to the History Factory podcast. I'm Jason Dressel. Be well.